like a lion in a cage.
CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
And today we're going to be talking about a number of things. We will speak with Robin Philpott in Montreal about the... this matter of the crisis at Attawapiskat, where we're going to ask about the condition of the Cree community in James Bay region. Mr. Philpott is someone who worked in that field and knows some, can provide us with some details. And later we're going to talk to Otis Richmond about the passing of Etta James and a man named Johnny Otis, who turns out his name was Billy Otis, and he's a big figure in what used to be called rhythm and blues. And the two of them knew each other very well, and their careers were intertwined. So we're going to ask about that. And then at the halfway point, we're going to be talking to a Montreal lawyer, Philippe Larochelle, who was one of the last, who made one of the last arguments on behalf of Leon Mugesera to prevent his transfer to Rwanda. And we're going to ask him about the outcome of, of that argument and what he thinks of Mr. Mugesera's prospects for fair trial, etc. We will also talk with Chris Black, who is a Toronto lawyer who has represented accused at the International Criminal Tribunal in Rwanda. He had a very important case representing General Ndilimana, one of the most celebrated cases at that tribunal. And in my opinion, he was victorious in that. He knows a tremendous amount about all these matters to do with genocide accusations and types of the quality of evidence, and he's going to tell us. He has a unique story to tell us about what he heard in an open court in Arusha in reference to Mr. Mugesera, so you want to hear that. And we are joined now by Robin Philpott. Are you there?
Hello?
Robin. Hello, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Robin, thanks very much for joining us. You have worked in this field of we want to talk about today, crisis, the ugly situation had developed at Attawapiskat.
Yeah.
And I want to go, this is a few, some of the commentary has touched on this, but there is a Cree community, broad Cree community, and it stretches from what we call Quebec to clear to the west, Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a community, a Cree community in Quebec, I think they're about, if I understand right, maybe 4,000, 6,000 people.
Oh, no. Closer to 20,000.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a large community.
No, it's not one. They're
It's the Attawapiskat is about 2,000, right?
Yeah, but no, but they consider, they are a community, they are a nation. They call themselves the James Bay Crees of Quebec. And
yes.
There are nine communities like Attawapiskat. I mean, and they operate as a nation. In other words, they as a group. I mean, a grouping of communities, and ever since the James Bay Agreement. And so each one of these communities, some of them are over 3,000-4,000, some are about 800 or 1,000, but they have a total of getting close to 20,000 people.
Yeah. By the way, the Cree Nation, broadly speaking, is a very large community.
If you talk about people who are Crees or...
About 200,000?
Oh, there's huge numbers. I mean, they are probably the most numerous of Aboriginal peoples in Canada.
Yeah. Now, let me... I'm sorry. I want to make sure I get... just starting with this point, what is the condition of that community, the James Bay Cree of Quebec?
Well, the James, there's absolutely no comparison. The nine, they don't even use the term reserve anymore. That was removed. The nine Cree communities in Quebec are all signatories of the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement, which was signed in 1975 when Quebec wanted to develop the hydroelectric potential. And it was quite a conflict, the early 70s that this took place, but they actually hammered out a good agreement, agreement which has been updated many times. And as a result of that, there was a transfer of money and a transfer, above all, which is most important, of control. And control of health and health services, control of education, control of the housing corporations, major change in how First Nations are managed their way. And there was a lot of money. So that each one of these communities in Quebec, you talk about Chisasibi, East Main, they're just across the James Bay from Attawapiskat and Fort Albany and the other Cree communities there. And it's night and day in terms of conditions.
Yeah. And conditions, just to be very...
conditions and economy.
Yeah, to be clear, I mean, it... frankly, it's at the border, right? I mean, in other words, we're not just talking about one community. The Cree of Quebec enjoy, frankly, a better standard of living. Is that right?
Well, much better, much better. In fact, there are Cree from Moosonee, which is close to the Quebec-Ontario border, who wanted to claim that they were Cree from Quebec in order to be part of the beneficiaries of the James Bay Agreement. And I think in some cases they actually succeeded. That framework established in 75 and then updated in 2002 by what they called La Paix des Braves, which is a peace. That is the framework within which economic development takes place, social services are provided, everything. And that does not exist for the Cree communities like Attawapiskat and others in Ontario. It just does not exist.
Because it's a different treaty arrangement.
Well, yeah, there you have to do a bit of history because in most of Canada, what the Canadian government wanted to do is they wanted to remove any kind of conditions, anything that would stop them from developing natural resources at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. So they signed these, what they called numbered treaties, and one of them is called the James Bay Treaty, signed in 1905. And the way it happened is that the Indian agent, Duncan Campbell Scott, who was a poet as well, and he was the guy who was in favor of total assimilation of the native people, he would travel in one case, the Albany River, and that's how it worked out with Attawapiskat, down the Attawapiskat River. He would meet people who hardly spoke any English or French or whatever. They would speak mainly Cree. And they would sign a treaty. And the treaty is what regulates their relationship with the governments now. And that treaty, it's ridiculous because what it says, what he did, he would give them a flag, sometimes a photo of the queen or the king. At the time, they would offer them land, a square mile per family of five people, with the proviso that if the government needed it for natural resources, it could take the land back. And they offered them $8 in cash and $4 every year forever. And that's the treaty.
He was a poet.
Yeah, he was a poet as well.
Yeah. Obviously, I'm going to have to guess he was a failed poet.
But he was the most person who really left his mark on Aboriginal relations in the early part of the 20th century. Yeah. That is why each one of these communities in Northern Ontario are just totally isolated. They have no negotiating power unless they can actually demonstrate get together and move public opinion. And in the Quebec side, until 75, it was a similar kind of situation.
Yeah. Now, Robert, before you go further, can I ask you this? Because we have to raise the name De Beers.
Yeah.
I think most people know what that is. It represents diamonds, and the next word is billions.
Yeah.
Now, they're there, and the Chief Spence is in Ottawa today and asking, demanding, it says, a revenue-sharing agreement with the company.
Yeah.
I don't know what her prospects are for that. Now, revenue sharing in Quebec, how does that work?
Well, the comparable situation is the agreement which was reached between the Cree of Quebec and then one particular community where the mine is, a Goldcorp mine, which is being, it's called the Eleanor Opinaka mine. And they reached an agreement. And I was looking over the press releases about it, and it was all based on the framework of the James Bay Agreement. And they reached an agreement, which everybody seemed happy with. Revenue sharing, they're even asking to have royalties. And the Quebec government they've been asking for royalties that the Quebec government does not even ask for.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, but they've managed to reach an agreement, which means that they're, in other words, forcing the company to give them contracts, forcing the company to hire Cree workers, a whole series of things, and this is all based on the precedent of the James Bay Agreement and what has followed. And so it actually gives them control, some control,
mm-hmm.
not total control by any means, but some control over development in their area and to ensure that the people in the area actually get part of the wealth, a share of the wealth, you know. And of course, the problem unless the Canadian government decides to force it upon the company, the companies have no obligation to do this. No, the mining companies have no obligation. The government will have to do it. But in Quebec right now, you have the framework.
Is an obligation.
Yeah, there is an obligation.
You have an agreement, and people have to live up to it.
Yeah, exactly. And they have to reach agreements. They can't just walk in because the actual development, how there's a process is determined in the James Bay Agreement and in the update in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
The process is determined in advance on how this should be done. This is not all over Quebec, by the way. This was the James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement, and I don't want people to think that this is
in every instance.
There are areas where this is not being done, and there are communities which have been left a bit. They've been sort of like forgotten groups. Mainly the Algonquin and the Atikamekw in Quebec are peoples who have not been able to, who have had fewer. They don't have the framework on which to work, on which to build upon.
Yeah. But here it would seem, I mean, obviously you have an example, a standard set that you have a Cree community of Quebec, which, as you say, is they have control, they have revenues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and by the way, the revenue is there. So long as you're producing gold or your hydro is operating, they're going to get their portion.
Yeah, they get their portion.
But in the case of De Beers, it's an exclusive situation. De Beers is a protected species. And nobody can do anything about it.
No. Well,
the feel-good articles and all the meetings in the world, unless they're going to say, yes, De Beers, you're going to have to redo this agreement and revenue's going to have to go directly to the Cree.
Right, right. But that would take tremendous willpower on the part of the government, and they're not. That's not.
Well, we have our own conscience to face here. Are Canadians going to say we're not going to put up with this type of treatment of our native fellow Canadians? We're not going to allow it.
No, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that's where the noise has got to come. But otherwise, this is going to be a big discussion of who's been up and have his visit and hand wringing.
Yeah, the worst thing about this is that. Ontario has a large native population, particularly in northwestern Ontario, and every year, stories like Attawapiskat are reported on, and yes. Northern Manitoba is the same thing, and you know
stories of this type.
Yeah, the same kind of thing. Northern Manitoba, Northern Saskatchewan, yeah. And they it goes right back to the Indian Act and the treaties. Basically, were land grab treaties signed in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Yeah.
That's where the problem is.
Yeah.
And
well, I'm glad. I'm really glad you identified that and underlined it. I'm afraid we're going to have to go.
Okay.
But by the way, we'd like to talk to you another day in greater detail because this is needs a focused treatment. I believe.
And just to complete what I want to say is that there was 20 years ago when there was the Oka crisis. There was a lot of bullying of Quebec going on the native issue, but people did not understand it, and unfortunately, the people still do not understand the differences and how they. In fact, there's some areas where the rest of Canada could learn a lot from Quebec.
Yeah, the quality of the treaties.
Yeah.
Well, we'll stop there and start there next time. Thank you very much, Robin.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye. Robin Philpott, and it is a matter we're going to revisit. We're going to be talking shortly, and while we're waiting for Otis, Phil, there's Irish news.
Yes, Phil. Today is a sad anniversary. 40 years ago today, the British Army in the city of Derry opened fire on an unarmed group of people demonstrating for their civil rights. It's known as Bloody Sunday. It's made immortal in the music of John Lennon and Paul McCartney, both who wrote songs about it. The British have tried to whitewash it. More recently, they had a very long inquiry that went up for 10 years, where they now say, yeah, well, we killed some innocent people. And yesterday in Derry, 10,000 people marched, despite the fact that the pikers didn't want them to march and said, that, well, the British have apologized now. It's an empty apology so far that nobody has been brought to justice. There's a website for Republican Sinn Féin, rsf.ie, and I urge our listeners to go and read the full story, the ongoing story of the Bloody Sunday massacre at www.rsf.ie.
Thanks an awful lot, Phil. And we're joined now, I think, by Otis Richmond. Are you there, Otis?
No.
No. I didn't think that was you. You're sounding in voice for somebody who's not there. Okay.
How are you doing?
Not bad. Johnny Otis. You didn't take your name from Johnny Otis, huh?
No, I took my name from Otis Williams and the Temptations. I could do a whole show on the name, but we're not here to talk about that today.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about these two people. And, you know, everybody wants to know, there was this unquestionably the phenomenon of the revolutionary phenomenon of so-called rock and roll. And when all this started, and everybody likes to, Elvis is everybody's favorite marking point. But in a way, these two individuals, Etta James and Johnny Otis, were pretty much could have been called the balance point, because there used to be we had race records and we had black music, which was highly segregated, and its performers, and then we had. The white pop world.
Oh, yeah.
And those two individuals were right there.
In the beginning.
And as my understanding is that the man Johnny Otis of California from Vallejo, a neighbor of yours, he had a lot to do with promoting Etta James. Can you talk about these two individuals? How do you think of them? Are they the kind of watershed people?
Well, first of all, I think the king and queen of rock and roll is Little Richard. He calls himself the king and queen of rock and roll.
I wonder what it is.
You know, you have people like Chuck Berry. You have people like Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, and people like that. But Etta James and Johnny Otis came shortly after that. Etta started out with Johnny Otis. Johnny Otis, by the way, discovered Little Willie John first, when Thanks. Little Willie John was 14 years old.
I take my hat
Johnny
off.
Otis came through Detroit and heard him at a place called the Paradise Theater. But Johnny Otis, I remember Johnny Otis, he had a television show in Los Angeles. And we're talking 50s. He had a television show in black and white. And, you know, I saw many of the greats, especially the local greats. And there is a clip on YouTube. I can send it to you, Phil, and I can share it with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Where he actually had Lionel Hampton on his TV show, and of course Etta James talks about Johnny Otis a lot in her book Rage to Survive, the Etta James story, which is written by Etta and David Ritz.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about the fact that Johnny Otis took her around, but we always thought that Johnny Otis was a black man, was an African.
Well, he was
a
volunteer.
Light skin.
I didn't
know for years until years later that he was actually Greek.
Isn't he a great cultural story? He's in his in obituaries. They quote him as saying, "He said I found out that there was a black world and a white world, and you had to choose. And he said I wanted to be in the black world."
Well, I guess he committed race suicide.
Suicide, and it's been advocated. It's probably good for you.
Well, his son
saved American culture. Can you imagine what it used? I mean, people ought to appreciate. They got to go back and listen to so-called pop music. That was a desert.
Well, I remember his big record was Willie and the Hand Jive, and yep. At that time, Bo Diddley had a song out called "Say Man,"
mm-hmm.
And I think when we go back to that Bo Diddley beat, you know, that Bo Diddley beat is really an African beat, and Marvin Gaye used to call Bo Diddley a certified witch doctor, and he wasn't saying that in a negative way. He was saying that, you know,
yeah, he could fix you
that
up.
He was a basically, his music was more African. And Johnny Otis, but back to Johnny Otis, Johnny Otis was responsible for Little Esther. We knew her as Little Esther, but she became Esther Phillips. And, you know, like a lot of people came from Louisiana and Texas and Mississippi, mm-hmm. Oklahoma, and everybody gravitated towards the Johnny Otis television show. And we watched that. I mean, I watched that religiously. Yeah. And Etta James, like I say, she was...
Can you imagine you could watch that and see people like Etta James and just... Oh, you're a fortunate man. Etta James... I lost my track too, but I'm going to ask you about Etta James. People use this expression today about being real. She was real from beginning to end. I mean... her name came up recently because the President of the United States and his wife had an anniversary, and the song had to be sung of, you know, the title. No, now I'm not going to be able to remember. But
At Last.
At Last. But that's an Etta James song, but they had Beyonce,
right.
Because they were comfortable with her. They one assumes they wouldn't. Maybe they wouldn't have been comfortable with Etta James, who was a real person, right?
Well, let me come to... I'm just going to sound crazy, but I'm going to come to the defense of Beyonce, not on that particular issue, but, you know, Beyonce made a film about Chess Records, and it was problematic on some levels. But I saw that film here in Toronto, Canada, at the Bloor Cinema. I didn't see it at one of the big the Bloor Cinema.
It's being talked about
theater,
a lot now.
But at the same time, Beyonce, Etta was really upset because Beyonce was going to sing her song at the inaugural for Barack Hussein Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the world is today, it is for young people. I really think that, you know, like Marilyn Monroe sang for John F. Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
and I think Madonna performed for...
Gaga.
Gaga performed for somebody.
For, yeah, Gugu. What's his name? Clinton.
No, it wasn't Gaga. It had to be Madonna because Gaga is today. Well, anyway,
we're piling up our stories. Yeah. Clinton had a big thing for Clinton recently, and Gaga sang at that.
Oh, okay. That's probably true.
He said he had a perfect night. He had Gaga there, and I forget who, Secretary of State, I guess.
Lady Gaga. But Etta was pissed off about that. And she called Beyonce everything but a child of God. and the way the media is, she didn't necessarily apologize, but, you know, she had to clarify what she had been saying.
Well, she knew how to kind of add a laugh, but she had a good pause. She waited for a month, and then she said, "I was just kidding." people should appreciate. They really broke through. They're tough people. They were tough their whole lives. And incidentally, you go to Doonesbury, the archives, and you can see Johnny Otis doing hand jive. And I really recommend it. It's only 2.5 minutes, but it's fantastic, him doing hand jive. But that man stepped out of music and for 10 or 15 years was the executive assistant to one of the most powerful and important black leaders in America, Mervyn Dimely.
And yeah, Mervyn Dimely,
he walked away from music.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
So who is it, Mervyn Dimely? How important was that?
Mervyn Dimely was a big politician in Los Angeles, California. He was a senator or congressman of California for many, many years. He was born in Trinidad and Tobago. He came to Los Angeles and was, you know, a pioneer in black politics. And I know a lot of people. In fact, I was speaking to a gentleman last night by the name of Kumasi, who was in prison with George Jackson. He wasn't in prison at the time George Jackson was killed at Soledad, but Mervyn Dimely came into the prison to see what, when George Jackson was killed. I mean, Mervyn Dimely came in and came into the prison, and people, Kumasi was telling me, had not Mervyn Dimely came in, they probably would have killed everybody in there.
Hey, think about that. You realize that he's standing there, and there's a guy, a Greek guy, standing with him, whose name is John Veliatis, and that's Johnny Otis.
he was
probably taking notes and making sure the meeting went well.
Right, and Johnny, Mervyn Dimely, to give you an example, Mervyn Dimely, I have a dear uncle who passed away recently, and Dimely and Uncle Tom Bradley, of the mayor of Los Angeles at the time, Mayor Bradley tried to use the fact that he was born in America, African American, as opposed to island guy like Dimely. So vote for me because I eat grits and.
Yeah.
And Mervyn Dimely eats roti, so, you know, you vote for me. And my cousin, my uncle told me that I'm going for the guy from the islands because Dimely is, I'm not Dimely, but, you know, Tom Bradley was always, when we were kids, I mean, he was a cop.
Yeah.
And we used to run from him because he was a very.
And that is why white liberals like Bradley. They said,
right.
Well, he's not only black, but he's a policeman, so
right.
We got it covered.
Right, and he was, Mervyn Dimely did a. Every time Stokely Carmichael, at the time he was Stokely Carmichael, but he was Kwame Ture, you know, in the 60s, he came to Los Angeles many, many, many times, and every time he spoke, Dimely was there.
Isn't that something? That's a great story. Norman, we're going to have to go. We really, really appreciate it. We're going to have to come back and talk to you someday. I'm going to ask you the big question to tell us about how rhythm and blues became rock and roll, but today we have to let it go.
All right. That's the rhythm and blues is... we'll talk about it.
Well, I like that very much. Thanks an awful lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. That is Norman Otis Richmond, and he knows wherever he speaks on music and politics. And we'll be talking shortly. We're going to be Mr. Philippe LaRochelle. I want to tout an article, today's Counterpunch. Go to counterpunch.com. Clancy Siegel is talking about how Obama is kidding himself in his love affair with the military, and he spotted a symptom, and he really put his finger on something. More and more now, we have people who never served in the military, who they're called commanders in chief, and they kind of civilians fall in love with, you know, being around uniformed people, and it doesn't seem to be good for their mental health. Anyhow, you got to read Clancy about why that's a dangerous thing. He uses the line. He says Obama says you got to have people who they have your back, and Siegel says that's what I'm worried about. Well, he's got that right. So you're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and you can write to us Taylor@CIUT.FM and check us out Taylor-Report.com, and. Are we going to take a break? I think we are. We'll take a little break and we'll come back and talk to Philip LaRochelle.
From the roots up. CIUT 89.5 FM, broadcasting live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. From Hart House, University of Toronto.
And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and I'm Phil Taylor. And we're joined now, I believe, by Philip LaRochelle. And I wanted to say it in by way of introduction that Mr. LaRochelle is a lawyer who has practiced more than 10 years at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. He's had a number of clients. He has a trial upcoming here in Canada, in Ottawa, in the spring, a major trial involving someone accused of crimes in Rwanda, and of course he has been visited Rwanda on several occasions and knows whereof he speaks. Are you there, Mr. LaRochelle?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, thanks very much for joining us. You represented Leon Mugesera in the latter stages of his struggle with the to remain in Canada. He had a number of arguments for that, but you specifically were addressing the issue of why he would be transferred from Canada to a country which many allege is guilty of all sorts of violations of people's human rights, but also of physically endangering people who come into their custody. And an element of that was you had argued that there is a United Nations commission on torture, and I believe you argued that they should be permitted to look at this case, and am I right? Did they accept to specifically this case? Did they say they would look into it?
Yeah, actually, what the way this functions is that very few countries have ratified an optional article of the Convention Against Torture, which gives the right to people who are facing deportation or extradition in any other way from Canada to seek seek a remedy before this committee, which is created by virtue of the Convention Against Torture, and which normally allows this committee against torture to assess whether there is a risk of torture in the country these people are about to be deported.
Mm-hmm.
And
I was struck by that. I mean, they simply brushed that aside.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the point. That's the very narrow issue that I represented Mr. Mugesera for, is that the Committee Against Torture was seized of a request by Mr. Mugesera and immediately requested Canada to postpone or to stay the pending extradition to allow them to make that assessment. And so this was done by a formal letter, formal diplomatic letter, which, according to many scholars, has some binding effect in Canada. But the Canadian authorities just decided to brush that aside, effectively rendering meaningless the optional ratification of the Convention Against Torture. But what's in essence, what is the point of allowing this body to assess the risk of torture if you send the person who's seeking that, who's looking for that assessment to be made, if you send them away before the assessment can effectively be made?
Yes. And what did you, you of course, as a lawyer, you have to put up with a lot of people second-guessing or speculating about. A lot of language came in such as, well, it's an abusive process, it's slowing everything down. And it became almost a sort of a conservative party argument for changing the way we handle cases of this type, where people are to be transferred, deported, et cetera. Can you comment on that?
I'm shocked by the attitude of the Canadian authorities in that file, but also in other cases where I was. Where I sought redresses before the Committee Against Torture. Again, it's like other international commitments that we seem to be in the process of just flushing down. You know, the Kyoto Protocol is one of them. There's going to be interesting issues arising from
what's going on at the international plane with regards to native people. But in that case, Rwanda is a special case, and Mugesera is a special individual to send over there. So I think it was very valid for a body such as the Committee Against Torture, which is much more objective, I think, in terms of assessing whether someone risks torture in being sent to a third country than the Canadian authorities, who have always made very clear that their intent was to deport the man. And as a Canadian first and as a lawyer second, I find it appalling that they would have such a blatant disregard for their international obligations. In effect, we were in correspondence with the representative of the Committee Against Torture, which sit in Geneva, and they simply would not believe for a minute that Canada would not abide by the request they had made in this case.
And unfortunately, the opposition parties were all kind of quiet. I mean,
I noticed, you know, I think it's a big sign of their state of disorganization, because you could see initially that the NPD stated that the man should be deported, and a few days later I saw another comment to the effect that Canada should give effect to the request of the Committee Against Torture. So I don't think they don't constitute, in that case anyway, did not constitute a valid obstacle to the Canadian government respecting its international commitments.
It does strike one that there's a kind of manipulation. Do you feel that perhaps your client was being turned into a kind of a poster boy for demonized individuals? I mean,
totally.
He got talked about in the strangest way.
He was used as a pretext to advance their agenda of having stronger laws in terms of immigration, in terms of criminal law. I think it was the perfect scapegoat for that, in fact, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can read you a quote from the media. It says, this is the minister himself speaking, Mr. Kenny. Our fair legal system has determined that he is here illegally. He's guilty of serious war crimes and that he has to face justice in his country of origin. I thought there was a presumption of innocence. I mean, it's one thing to say he's accused of.
Because they never assessed that he was guilty. That's complete bullshit. Because what they assessed was that he was inadmissible. He was never found guilty on a criminal standard. I don't have it in mind because I did not do the whole exercise of the immigration process. But the process there is not whether he's guilty or not. The man was never afforded a defense or anything. Mm-hmm. The process was simply to address on a lighter standard whether it was likely that he had committed these offenses or anything, but never was he found guilty of those, first. Second, mm-hmm. fair justice system is another wrong or misleading statement, because we know for a fact that the Canadian government actually hid a lot of material that demonstrated that the place where he was about to be sent is run by a criminal organization since July 1994. That is the RPF, and that's within their own documentation, which was never disclosed to Mr. Mugesera. And then that they would act on democratic assurances from a criminal organization, what is the value of those? And this is why it is so important to have a final assessment in those countries that decided to have it done by the Committee Against Torture, because this is a place where people may have been more likely to speak more frankly. They have rules of confidentiality, which may respect the anonymity of people who have things to say about all of those things. But unfortunately, for reasons that are their own, they decided to brush all of that aside and send the guy away.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, if the minister is going to be so strong in his convictions based on no evidence, since there never was any test of it, legal test, I suppose many Canadians would like to know why didn't they charge Mr. Mugesera here, as they have. And you do have a client, for example, you're representing, who the trial will be coming up, I understand, in the spring. But why wouldn't they have accused Mr. Mugesera here and settled? They could.
They were. This is what I also find shocking. I know for a fact that they investigated the case over there. So the decision to send Mr. Mugesera away and to hold trials for other people in Canada is purely political. There is no a fair assessment, an open, transparent and fair assessment of the situation in Rwanda with regards to the chances, the very high chances that it will get a completely unfair trial over there, I think was militating to hold this trial here, and especially after all this time that he had spent in our country. Why? What was the rush? And what was? I mean, not so long ago, Rwanda was still one of the very few countries on this select club of other countries where they would not send people away, such as Congo or countries with a disturbing political record. And all of a sudden, the situation changed very recently, actually, and they decided, I think, I suspect that they are advancing political purposes, you know, more than anything else, yes, by deciding to ship that man away.
There does seem to be, I wonder if you could, I mean, maybe you're alluding to it now, and that the International Criminal Tribunal, where you have represented accused and very successfully, has decided at this very late stage in its existence to transfer one of the accused to Rwanda. And I noticed all the editorialists here wrote about that. And we're hearing, last week on this program, we spoke to people in Zambia who say that the refugee community there is having its status changed. It does seem like there's some sort of high-level decision to alter the conditions of those Rwandans in the diaspora.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. There are some, we can perceive some changes, but there are also, in other countries, there is still the realization that it is not safe to send people to have their trials.
Well, Britain,
there.
I guess, Britain refused
France
to.
Also. France is also, it's not very publicized, but I know that in cases, France has refused to deport people to Rwanda. So I think it's the there's still a divide as to whether it's safe to, or not to send people there, a divide which is strong enough, I think, to be cautious about it, and especially if you have laws that allow you to have the trial of that man here in Canada, which my opinion is that it would have been much better to have his trial here now.
Yeah, particularly since, as Canadians, we've all been talking about him for 17 years. We probably ought to make our own determination.
Of course. There would have been time to do his trial two times, you know?
Yes.
And to go all the way up to the Supreme Court also on the trial itself, not on whether it's admissible or not. This was, people take great, the decision in the Supreme Court is usually quoted as the main reason why he should be deported. But I would like to stress that the decision of the Supreme Court is only about whether he's admissible or not. And again, was taken on a standard that is not the criminal standard. So there was no decision by the Supreme Court that it was safe to send him back to Rwanda. This decision was taken by a delegate of the minister and is still the object of review by the federal court. So it's actually, so far, it's the decision of one person delegated by the minister on which this decision rests, not by the Supreme Court. This is completely misleading to say that the Supreme Court had anything to say with regards to whether or not it was safe to send him back to Rwanda.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. You really clarified that. Philip La Rochelle, thank you very much. We really appreciate this.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
All right. Bye-bye. And that was Philip La Rochelle, who's done outstanding work at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and knows, again, I have to emphasize, really knows what he's talking about. And he's been in every corner of this issue of the 1994 events. We're going to be speaking shortly with Chris Black. I'll just tell you again, Clancy Siegel, today's Counterpunch, terrific article about you better look out when you have political leaders who are taken in by men in uniform. The quotes he has from Obama, I was shocked by the way. I had not seen them. I believe we're joined now by Chris Black. Are you there, Chris?
That's right. Hello. How are you doing, Phil?
Very good. Hey, Chris, thanks an awful lot. We're just speaking to Mr. La Rochelle, and you know him as a colleague of yours and fought hard in the same trenches as you have.
Right, we all suffer the same scars.
Yeah, this is Chris Black, who has fought a very long case and, in my opinion, was victorious. I know there's always edges to these things and elements, but involving the General Dendele Mana. Chris, in your trial, a very this matter of the name Mugesera came up, and your examination of a witness who, if I remember rightly, had been one a member of the prosecuting team that looked into the original charge, starting in 1992 in Rwanda, you had him in person on the stand, and a lot of he said he used the word mystery in regard to Mr. Mugesera and his famous alleged speech. Can you want to talk about what did you make of that?
Right. His name was Stanislaus Harelimana. He was the deputy attorney general in Rwanda.
A witness with a name. Isn't that amazing?
Right. He had a code name, but he refused to use it, testified openly. That's another issue, these code names.
I have a lot of respect for him.
So he was the, what we'd call a deputy attorney general, but the prosecutor for the Court of Appeals concerned with state security matters and, basically state security matters. So if the Minister of Justice ordered someone to be arrested, he would be the man to issue the warrants and so on, which is what he did with the Mugesera case. Now, the puzzle with that was that he explained to the tribunal that the speech that was recorded, first issued summaries by the press at the time, did not mention anything bad about the speech or attacks on Tutsis, as he's accused of now.
No reference to the famous river?
No, nothing. And the original cassette apparently did not have any such recording of his speech, did not have any such words contained in it. And so he was asked how it came about that Mugesera was prosecuted, and he stated that the original complaint came from Faustin Twagaramungu, and there was the manager of the Radio Rwanda, who was hostile to the regime, actually was maybe involved in making a second tape. It's very muddy what happened to the original tape, but it seems to have disappeared or pops up and disappears again.
Specifically, by the way, because people think here that there was a broadcast of his speech on Radio Rwanda in 1992, but that's not true.
There was a broadcast of his speech, what he actually said, but it did not contain what he's now accused of saying. The speech that Faustin Twagaramungu complained about and reported to the Ministry of Interior, and they issued a warrant, was based on just Twagaramungu's say-so and people supporting him, and opposed to the MRND, of which Mugesera was a member. They reported that he said these bad words, attacking Tutsis and raising ethnic tensions. But the actual speech, as reported at the time by the journalist who was there, did not contain any such language, and the original cassette apparently did not either. So Harelimana said the whole thing about the tape was a mystery. Where was the original tape? And who had it? And we wanted to find Mugesera to interview him to find out exactly what he did say. But he was afraid of what was going on, so he fled the country.
Exactly. Well, as a matter of fact, it's very important people understand that that government at that time was the various ministries were divided according to political party.
Yes.
People here carelessly use the word dictator in reference to Habyarimana, but the minister of justice and the minister of the interior, each of those people would have had. Belonged to a party other than the president's.
Right. They belonged, both the Ministry of Interior and the Ministry of Justice were assigned to pro-RPF people in the Liberal Party, the PL Party. And so the Minister of Justice, Ingipito, joined the regime after the RPF took power. And he was the Minister of Justice at the time. And the Minister...
In 1992.
Yeah, the Minister of Interior was, I forget the name now, but he was also linked with the RPF.
Yeah.
So Mugesera rightly thought he was being targeted and going to be set up on false charges and left the country.
And which, by the way, explains why no human rights organizations were upset that he had left the country, right?
No, that's right. They were not.
Because at that time, the target was President Habyarimana.
Yes.
So if President Habyarimana said that Mr. Mugesera was a bad person or his government, then he should be protected.
Right. People don't understand that. People don't understand that at that time, President Habyarimana had almost no power, which when the Arusha Accords was set up, the broad-based transitional government, he was reduced to really just a figurehead. Mm-hmm. And the real power lay with the prime ministers, and all three prime ministers from 1992 through 94 were pro-RPF.
Well, and they, and as a matter of fact, specifically, it was assigned to the MDR party.
Correct.
Which was opposed to him, to
right.
opposed to the president.
Right. The idea that President Habyarimana was a dictator, the RPF had to overthrow a regime, it's a nonsense because it was a coalition government containing representatives from all the major parties through agreement, including representatives of the RPF.
Yeah. So. Now, well, you know, now that hit, I was so important, by the way, and I congratulate you that you pursued this, and matter of fact, you had to, didn't you? I mean,
right.
because you had a witness, a rather famous American woman, Alison DeForge, who, and whenever she gave expert testimony, she liked to always include an element about Leon Mugesera.
Right, and she did that in our trial. She raised it as an. It was alleged against the accused in our trial that they had conspired to plan genocide. Or conspired to commit genocide, and one of the allegations was that, for instance, my man had not, head of the police, had not gone after Mugesera, and so we examined what the contents of the speech actually were. It was an important issue for us. That's why we got into it.
Mm-hmm.
And Alison DeForge, Dr. DeForge, was criticized by the judges in our trial in the judgment for misleading the court.
For misleading the court.
Right. She issued, yeah. she had...
I'm going to emphasize.
Yeah, it's very strong language from the tribunal. They said that in the Bagasora case, a Military One case, she had given an expert report. In that report, she mentioned very, very positive things about my client, the head of the National Police.
Mm-hmm.
He was a hero, basically. In the report for his own trial, which she was asked to produce by the prosecutor, she deleted all those comments. And tried to pass it off and hope nobody would notice, but we attacked her on that. Why did she take out all the positive things about this man in his own trial? And she had no explanation.
It is rather striking that she thought that she was going to sit down as a witness in front of a counsel on behalf of General Dindilimana and not have some have that counsel point out that she had deleted references to his client.
Yeah, it was bizarre because. It was clear that the prosecutor and her were so arrogant and had been used, I don't want to criticize many previous counsel, but over time we learned that you could start questioning what was going on. We learned more about what happened in the war. It wasn't what they said.
Mm-hmm.
So people became more confident. But they actually expected there would be no cross-examination because she had never really been really, really attacked in cross-examination before. Maybe something like Tefan Dixon did and some other people, but
mm-hmm.
we had the information to use against her, and mm-hmm. we had the real facts where she was putting out just pure propaganda.
Yeah, I think Tefan was more, Dixon was more fortunate, and she had Philip Renschens.
Yes.
Who
right.
Philip Renschens seems to suffer from a real conscience. He actually speaks the truth.
Yes. Yeah, he's actually
By the way, he's joined in on the issue around Mugesera, right? And
yeah.
He doesn't believe Mugesera is safe in Rwanda.
No, he wrote a report, which I used. We filed, many of us filed reports with the Canadian Border Services Agency, David Jacobs, myself, and many other people. The International Association of Democratic Lawyers filed a brief for him. Renschens' report was part of that, in which he said it's a dictatorship. It's not even a country with an army. It's an army with a country. I think that phrase explains exactly what Rwanda is. So Mugesera being said, he was betrayed by Canada, as far as I'm concerned. He was given refuge. He deserved to have refuge. He's being politically persecuted unjustly. And now he's been betrayed by the people that gave him refuge and sent back to the very criminals that set him up in the first place. It's disgusting.
Yeah. By the way, I mean, again, we'd have to say also that if whatever he was to have uttered in 1992, it was speech, and he was not in the country and committed no offense and never advocated during that time of violence, participated at all in any of it.
Right. And there were worse things going.
It's a kind of political. I wonder if you would agree. There's a kind of political hysteria here where
yes.
we invoke a name.
Right.
It's like witch hunting.
Right. And Deputy Attorney General Haralamana brought that up in the trial. He explained that, for instance, they had ordered Hassan Ngezi, Kangura newspaper, arrested and some others for inciting ethnic tensions. But they were all released eventually because the Rwandan government got pressure from human rights groups like Human Rights Watch and Alison DeForge and Amnesty International that they were arresting journalists, and it's all about freedom of speech.
Oh, I'm really glad you point this out. I read it, and we're going to have to find a way to post it so people can see this. He said that his minister was under great pressure, and then I think he read the document out. Amnesty
yes.
called Mr. Ngezi a
yes.
journalist.
Yes. So, and the same would have happened with Mugesera's speech if he'd been picked up. I'm sure Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch would have given him the same treatment. What are you doing? It's a free country, isn't it? It's democracy. You're allowed to say what you want to say.
Yes.
And but that was the double game they were playing. So
it's just, and of course, as it redounded on your client, they were attempting. Here he had the evidence. Mr. Jaramillo was that the gendarmerie were very professional and acted on their instructions just as they asked them to do.
Right.
And on this case of Mugesera, 1992, they were doing everything they were asked to do.
Correct. Right. They acted on the instructions. There was a warrant issued. It was never put into effect because Mugesera left the country.
And then there's an attempt to smear your client by saying he was involved in a conspiracy with the very man that he and others were attempting to prosecute.
Exactly. Everything was turned upside down, and it's like Alice in Wonderland. Red was black, and white is yellow, and it was all. When you look at
Alice
what happened in Rwanda,
Alice
nothing
in
makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I can. I once sat in court and heard Alison DeForge ask for a break because she needed to go on personal business somewhere, and Judge Kama said to her, "I can refuse you nothing."
Yes, that's the way she was treated. She was treated like a saintly figure.
Yeah,
and she's being criticized by several courts for not being forthright.
Which, by the way, speaks to, and you should, I should close on this. You, as defense counsel, were not taken in by the celebrity of the witness. I mean, you simply treated her like a witness who'd been slandering your client, right?
Right. And she didn't like it because I cross-examined her as I normally would have witnessed in a criminal trial here, and she did not like it one whit. She objected and threatened to walk out of the courtroom if I continued to ask questions. But the judges did not like the way she was acting and what she had done, and they looked. I've never seen them look so unhappy with a witness mm-hmm. before.
And it was reflected in what they wrote in their judgment.
What they wrote in their judgment.
It's
yes.
very important people hear this, Chris. We're very grateful that you could join us today. It's very informative, and we hope to get back to you. I think there's more to be talked to about what you learned during that trial. It was very
yes.
edifying. Thank you.
Anytime. Okay. You're welcome.
Chris Black. That's an important story, which you're listening to Taylor Report, you may know about it. Otherwise, you're in the dark. We live in the heart of darkness. I can prove it. This is North America, and the capitals of Washington are much less informed than you would find in any capital in Africa and the Middle East, around the world, actually. The populations there are much more sophisticated because they're less controlled by the media. So this is Phil Taylor for Phil Conan and Carol, and write to us, Taylor at CIUT.fm, and check us, Taylor-Report.com. And we'll be with you next week.